Welcome to another podcast from the Chapter House, a gathering place for teaching and other interesting conversations from the Ministry of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. A chapter house is a room or a building attached to a cathedral where meetings are held. In monastic communities, the monks would meet there to read aloud from the Bible or discuss theology. Come on in to the Epiclesis Chapter House. Our next gathering is just about to begin. Now, here's Pastor Chris.
Well, folks, welcome back to another conversation with the talented and handsome Steve Pearson. Hi, Steve, and welcome back.
Good afternoon, first off. But the handsome part, that caught me off guard there. For those of you who haven't seen me, I've been thinking, how would I give a physical description? And basically, I am slight of build with no hair on the top of my head.
So are you kind of like a hobbit then?
You know, I have sort of hairy feet. My wife compared them the other day to, she said they look like the feet of something that would climb down out of the mountains and stalk wild animals or something like that. I don't remember the exact words, but
a diminutive Sasquatch? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, that's something of what we're going for here.
Folks, I've got Steve Pearson with me. He's my buddy from Nebraska, but he is a pastor way up in Canada. We've become friends over the last few years, and most importantly of all, he is coming to Sacramento in October 17, 18, for a wonderful retreat ostensibly about Lord of the Rings, but oh, so much more. And Steve, we have already had one conversation. It was kind of an umbrella that we sort of put over the whole of the topic. And folks, I want to encourage you to go to the Epiclesis website, look under resources and podcasts, and you'll find that first conversation with Steve. And I want to thank you, by the way, for doing that. But now, as we get ready to talk about each of the three movies in the trilogy, I asked you to come back, Steve, so we could talk about them in succession. Our congregation is going to divide up over the summer and watch each of these movies in the trilogy. And you had the great idea, I think it was you anyway, that, hey, why don't we have a conversation about each one of those so that people might want to listen to it either before or after or both?
It is a great way to get an introduction to The Lord of the Rings if you watch the Peter Jackson trilogy. I will say that there are a few places in there that it diverges from the book, and there are a number of episodes in there that dialogue has changed a little bit. There are a few episodes in the book that are not included in the movies, most notably being Tom Bombadil in the first book, The Fellowship of the Ring. But otherwise, I think Jackson does a really good job of cinematically catching the flavor of Tolkien and the major scenes and the major flow of thought, so to speak.
Agree. I love them. We have some real diehard fans here in my congregation, and they, at least two of those families, are going to host some movie watch parties. But one already said to me, all right, people just need to understand that if they're coming to my house, we're going to watch the uncut version. And there could be absolutely no talking. I'm not even sure I'm going to, you know, feed snacks. She was half kidding, but half not, because, you know, she's just really, really a huge fan, as you are. Would you say that you rise to the level of Lord of the Rings nerd? I mean, you really, really, really know a lot about all of it.
Well, just when I think I know a lot of all of it, I read a book that has a bunch of things in it, or I listen to a podcast that leaves me feeling absolutely ignorant of it. I'll give you one quick example of something I learned the other day that made me feel absolutely pathetic in my knowledge of Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
So the Feast of the Annunciation, I believe, is on March 25th each year in the liturgical calendar year. And the Feast of the Annunciation celebrates both ostensibly the conception of Christ and then his death on the cross as well, March 25th. Now, we know that Easter usually is a floating date because of a number of things. But here's what I didn't realize, and that is that in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, March 25th is also the time that the ring is destroyed in Mount Doom.
Well,
and so Tolkien is making this parallel between the ring being destroyed and the Feast of the Annunciation, because he was a diehard Catholic, right, lived and died by the liturgical year. He put together the Middle Earth calendar and the destruction of the ring calendar based around the liturgical year. So it ends up March 25th, the ring is destroyed.
I had no idea. Hold on. Wow. I had no idea. See, he arranged the thing around the liturgical calendar year?
Yes, it was not by accident that March 25th ends up being the day that the ring is destroyed, that the final confrontation with Sauron occurs, is on March 25th, which is Feast of the Annunciation.
Well, are there other dates that correspond in the books to some significant feast day or point in the Christian calendar?
You know, that's one that I need to do a little more research on.
Oh, that'd be
but there are some things that I think that revolve around Yule. And in The Lord of the Rings, it's not specifically like we think of Yuletide and right. Yuletide is Christmas. And in The Lord of the Rings, it's not specifically related to Christmas. I do need to do a little more research because I think there are some other dates that correspond and ways he set it up specifically, like when they left Rivendell. I was reading some about that last night, and it's going to escape me the exact.
Well, that's okay. No, there's a niche for you to write a book, Lord of the Rings and the Christian calendar. I haven't seen anything like that. I don't think.
Well, I think it would be interesting to write a book if one were directing, say, a doctoral thesis in this sort of area. Because
nobody else is going to really care. Is that what you
think? No one else is really going to care. But what I found interesting. When you dig into Tolkien's letters, and eventually we'll get to Fellowship of the Ring and that sort of thing, but when you dig into Tolkien's letters, you find that he absolutely loved the Eucharist, that his whole life was centered around both his Catholic faith, but in a more intense sense. And I was trying to find the quote here I had from his letters, but he absolutely just felt a special place in his heart in his devotional pursuits for the celebration of the Mass. Mm. And you can see that in how he refers to Lembas bread, the elven bread that sustains the hobbits going into Mordor.
Oh, yes. Let me just pause for half a jiffy to say, folks, you're listening to the second in a continuing small series of conversations with Steve Pearson. He's going to be leading a retreat for us in the fall of 2025. If you are in our area and interested in attending, just zip over to the Epiclesis website. That's epiclesis.org. And you'll see a thing there under news about the fall retreat. And make sure you get your reservations in. We'll be opening those reservations sometime this month of July. Steve, last time we did kind of an overview. And then at the end, I asked you to tease out some themes, maybe two or three big chunks of themes that you'd like for us to focus on and that we may also hit at the retreat. Power, fellowship, the way these characters are bound to one another, and also sovereignty and freedom. We might, and I'm hoping we will, apply those lenses to this first in the series of the movies. But maybe the place to start in this conversation is for you to give us, well, more than a cursory overview, give us a pretty good synopsis of this first installment in the trilogy and introduce us to the main characters and sort of where we pick up and then where we leave off at the end of the first movie of the trilogy.
Brief synopsis. Mm-hmm. There.
I'll bet you could do it.
I appreciate you having that kind of confidence in me. The whole movie takes place in Middle Earth. And we'll get to a couple of details about where Middle Earth is and that sort of thing in a moment. But it is a time when there are knights that are chivalrous, when there are grand battles fought. Some of it reflects, say, the English countryside. Some of it reflects some Norse mythology. It takes place in this sort of setting. And it starts out in the Shire, which you could say is 19th century England, reflective of Tolkien's early childhood, which was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He loved just this sort of simple, idyllic English countryside, people that attended to simple pleasures. They're the hobbits, 3-4 feet tall at the most, big hairy feet, but they like things like drinking good ale and growing living things. They love gardening. They love the simple pleasures of life, of friendship, a night down at the pub. All of these sorts of things are hobbit life. They're simple characters that love to stay in their own region, except for one of them, and that is Bilbo Baggins. And he comes from the trilogy The Hobbit, which was before this written by Tolkien. He had some adventures there. He's come into possession of a ring, simple gold-looking wedding band type ring. He has this ring, and he has a nephew who he's very fond of and who is a dear friend named Frodo. Bilbo decides that he has had enough time in his area of Hobbiton there, and he's going to go live with the elves. He's fairly old, 111 years old, wants to go live with the elves, and he knows the elves from his previous adventures. He wants to go live with them, so he throws himself a big birthday party, and one of the powers of this magic ring that he has is it makes him disappear. He disappears at his birthday party, and he takes off to go to the elves. He leaves the ring to Frodo as well as his home there in town under the supervision of a wise old wizard called Gandalf that checks in on Frodo every once in a while. Gandalf realizes this ring is actually one out of 20 rings that controls the other rings, so to speak, for lack of a better way to phrase it. It controls all these other rings that were given to men, given to elves, and given to dwarves. None were given to hobbits, but this one ends up in the possession of Frodo. There is an evil character in this whole thing called Sauron. He wants to get control of this ring that he lost, this magic ring that is amongst these poor, simple hobbits. Gandalf realizes this, and he encourages Frodo to take the ring to Rivendell, where the elves live. There will be a council. The wise elves, along with Gandalf, will figure out what to do with this ring. The journey begins. This quest begins. Along the way, we pick up three other hobbits to go with him, his close friend and gardener, Samwise Gamgee, along with two others called Merry and Pippin. These four hobbits go to the village Bree. They're being chased by some agents of Sauron, the Dark Lord. They get to the village Bree, and they meet an unlikely character there, a rough-looking character named Strider. He is a ranger of the north. We would consider him a lone wolf, but a good guy, but rough. He takes them to Rivendell. Along the way, Frodo gets stabbed by a sword of one of the bad guys. They're called the Dark Riders, one of the bad guys. And he suffers this wound, which you think it might claim his life. It doesn't. He gets to Rivendell soon enough. The power of the elves heal him. A council is called. You have dwarves there, you have elves there, men there, and these four hobbits. There's a lot of discussion, arguing, history about the ring given. The ring cannot be destroyed by any craft that these people, this group of beings, possess. You can't smash it. That's tried. You can't melt it down. None of that works. The Dark Lord wants it because it will give him back the power over all Middle-earth. His power had been poured into that ring in the beginning. He lost the ring in battle. He wants it back. That will allow him to control the other rings and to control all of Middle-earth. But it needs to be destroyed by going to a place called Mount Doom. It's basically a volcano. It needs to be destroyed there, dropped into the volcano. You have an argument amongst all of these great warriors, great minds, sages that have been alive, some of them for decades, centuries. And they're all arguing, how do we destroy this ring? Finally, Frodo steps up and says, I'll do it. A fellowship is formed. And there are nine of these characters that come together. The four hobbits, Strider, this ranger, Boromir, who is one of the warriors, the son of the steward of Gondor. He lives just across the river, basically, from the lands of the Dark Lord. You have him, you have Legolas, one of the woodland elves, Strider, and you have Gandalf. And then you have Gimli, one of the dwarves. They form this tight-knit fellowship to escort Frodo carrying the ring to Mount Doom. Problem. The ring begins to transform anyone who carries it and has it. It becomes a literal weight, a spiritual weight, an emotional weight, all of these things on this person, and begins to transform them into someone who absolutely loves this ring and will do anything, including murder, to keep it. It begins to work on Frodo. They travel further. They go through the mines of Moria, through the mountain. While they're going through this mountain, on the way to Mount Doom, Gandalf is lost into the abyss. He does battle with a Balrog, which is a demon of the deep. They continue on. They go through some elven lands, Lothlorien. They meet a couple of really wise elves, Celeborn and Galadriel. She has some conversations with Frodo. They continue on, comes to a place where they're fighting orcs, which are more of the bad guy's servants. While they're fighting orcs, Boromir is killed, and Frodo decides to go on by himself, that he would do better at this point without the whole fellowship together. He continues on by himself. However, Samwise Gamgee, his loyal gardener, says, I know you're going to go on alone, but I'm going with you. And the first movie ends with Sam and Frodo looking out over a barren wasteland, and Frodo looks at Sam and says, Sam, I'm glad you're with me.
Let me stop to say, folks, you're listening to a conversation with Steve Pearson. He is my Lord of the Rings guy. He's also a friend and a pastor, and he's going to lead a retreat for us here at Epiclesis in Sacramento in the fall, October 17 and 18. Ostensibly, we're talking about Lord of the Rings at this retreat, but it's going to be so much deeper. I mentioned a few minutes ago that our church is going to kind of break up into different small groups and watch each of the three volumes of the trilogy. What Steve has just talked about now is the first in the series of three movies, and it's called The Fellowship of the Ring. And that's really the meat of that particular volume. There's a problem, a fellowship of people come together to solve it, and they set off on a journey. Steve, a question for you, or two. I remember when the Harry Potter books came out, there was a whole plethora of especially conservative Christians who were upset about that. Help us understand myth. Help us understand how things like this can get us to look at our own faith and the truth of our faith and theological concepts, maybe in a way that people wouldn't have first thought of. A
couple of things. First, to respond to the Harry Potter dilemma, I'll call it. And scripture is very clear to stay away from the dark arts, to stay away from necromancy, to stay away from fortune telling, these sorts of things. In Lord of the Rings, for example, if you want to say something about magic, magic is only done by beings that are not human. In the history of Lord of the Rings, Gandalf is called a wizard, but he is actually more of an angelic being sent by the Iluvatar, through a number of different twists and turns, Iluvatar being, or Eridu being, I think it's Eridu, being Tolkien's mythical name for God. And we'll get to myth in just a moment. So it's not as if it is humans doing bunches of magic in this saga. Tolkien himself actually did not like magic being used by humans for this reason. Magic requires power over somebody. And he was actually against it for that reason alone.
You mean as a literary device?
As a literary device, he was actually against it. And you don't really see in Lord of the Rings what we would call humans, and they have the race of men in there, what we would call humans doing magic.
Gotcha.
And he has a whole creation myth, a whole system of how the fall happened and how evil entered in and beings that are sent to help people in Middle Earth when needed. And Gandalf is one of those, more of an angelic being that exercises it. But it rarely even then is portrayed as an abracadabra magic. You know, say we need bread, wave a wand, there's bread.
Gotcha.
It doesn't work like that. It is more along the lines of what we would call spiritual strength and power that Gandalf has. And I'll illustrate it this way. If you've ever prayed with an old saint that you know knows God, and it sends shivers down your spine because you know things are moving in the spiritual world when this person prays.
Yeah.
And it's not that they, you know, oh, hey, I don't like that tree over there. I'm going to pray that tree away. They are doing deep spiritual work in their communion with God through prayer. That's the way even Gandalf has been portrayed many times, as having deep spiritual power that way, not an abracadabra. I was watching The Hobbit last night, and at one point someone complains, it's raining, Gandalf, what kind of wizard are you if you can't stop it? And he says, look, it's raining. You want a wizard who can stop the rain, you have to find yourself another wizard. Basically, I don't do magic just to do these little magic tricks. That's not what it is.
Well, what about the issue of myth? The last conversation we had, we talked about the concept of mythos, and that word can be applied to the Christian faith, but in a good way. Can you walk us through that again so people understand where we're coming from?
Absolutely. Tolkien wrote an essay called On Fairy Stories. It's not spelled F-A-I-R-Y, it's F-A-I-R-I-E, I believe the older English spelling of it.
Yes.
You can find that online. Lewis wrote about mythology and myths and its use in theology. I don't want to say dumb this down, but put it in terms that a country boy like me can understand. Our lives are shaped deeply by story. Tolkien and Lewis understood this. We would like to think of ourselves as enlightened, rational beings. Pastor, if you and I have, say, a theological difference, we resort to cold, hard reason and hermeneutics and things, or we're arguing about something in culture and I bring reason, you bring reason. Rarely are we actually shaped that way. Our loves and our passions and our focus in life are shaped deeply by stories, culture shaped by stories.
Indeed, yes, yes.
Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, I think maybe I referenced this last time, I'm not sure, but he talks an immense amount in his book, Secular Age, about a social imaginary. How do we envision ourselves as a culture? And a lot of that is not even conscious, but it's shaped by story. For example, I could argue for a libertarian version of freedom, like everybody should be allowed to make choices as long as they don't infringe on somebody else in culture, blah, blah, blah. But I could also inspire you with a vision of something like the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, the story of the Minutemen at Concord. These are stories that in just a couple of days we're going to celebrate July 4th, the Day of Independence. These are the stories that have shaped our national social imaginary, who we view ourselves as, our national identity. As Christians, we have this. And I could go into that even more, but it is stories that shape our loves and shape our conceptions of what life is about. Lewis and Tolkien understood this deeply.
Yes.
And so they write myth, but they don't dismiss myth as, well, simply not true. Why should I pay attention to it? They understood they could communicate theology and deep spiritual lessons through stories, powerful, moving stories.
Which is exactly, frankly, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, that's exactly what Jesus is doing, right?
Parables.
Yeah.
He taught in so many different parables. Rarely did he engage. No, I shouldn't say rarely, but when you look at his teaching, there weren't three-point sermons. There weren't tons of just rationally argued, logical arguments like we would think. We, as sort of children of the Enlightenment, want to squeeze every bit of non-scientific existence out of existence. We look at trees moving, and Tolkien might say, oh, those are the Ents, which you will meet the Ents in Lord of the Rings. Those are Ents moving slowly through the forest, shepherd of the forest. We sit there, no, that can't be. It's air moving because today it's warmer out and it's supposed to cool off in a day or so, so the airflow is doing this and that. Even as Christians, we squeeze all beauty out of creation sometimes by scientific minds. And myth allows us to look at it beautifully enchanted, not some weird way, but to learn from deep stories that these men have the power to create that reflect deep spiritual values and shape us in magnificent ways.
That's really well said. That those things shape us. We might not even be aware of their shaping, but they do shape us.
I'll give you one beautiful example from liturgy. You get to the liturgy, and some churches take it monthly, some take it every week. Personally, I'm a little partial to the every week thing. I absolutely love that. Our tradition doesn't do that, but I love that because what you do is you visually are retelling this story that draws us into it each week. It's a story. It's not like I make a logical argument for some particular atonement theory. Right. I invite you to experience the beauty of the body and blood of Christ. 1 Corinthians says it so beautifully. And to go through that story each week. So I'm trained by each week listening to certain words to see the world differently by listening to this story.
Yes, indeed. My mentor, Robert Weber, used to say that worship does God's story. And you can say, if you're using sort of a more traditional definition of myth, that worship, and perhaps particularly table, is Christian mythology, in that myth simply means a narrative theme or plot structure. It's a set of beliefs or assumptions. People hear the word myth and assume that we're saying make-believe and untrue. But to think of it in terms of how Lewis and Tolkien would have thought of it, it's a theme, it's a plot structure, it's a set of stories, it's a set of beliefs or assumptions about something. And we Christians have the best story of all.
I think Lewis would say something to the effect of, it is the myth that happens to be true.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so he's not disregarding the truth of the resurrection. In fact, he argued at length for the truth, the literal truth of Christ's claims. And Tolkien was rooted in literal history. He's not dismissing it. But what they're inviting us into is allow the story to shape you. Here is one of the beautiful things that happened in preaching in the last several decades, is the focus on story, creating this narrative that draws people in, begins to ask, where am I in this narrative? Who am I in this narrative? What characteristics do I see in Scripture and in this story, rather than this logical three-point sermon? I'm not saying forget logic, but we are storied individuals. And so myth, all societies have them, all cultures have them. They have these stories that shape who they are, and the Christians have the true story, but there are echoes of that story in lots of other myths and cultures. Lewis and Tolkien were experts in it, and they bring this to the fore in their writings, and particularly Lord of the Rings. So a Christian who's like, why do I need myth? I would say, open yourself up to allowing beautiful stories rooted in a Christian worldview to shape you.
Wonderfully said. Folks, you're listening to Steve Pearson. He's talking to me today about Lord of the Rings, and more particularly the first movie in the trilogy called Fellowship of the Ring. Earlier, Steve did a tour de force of the synopsis of the first volume. And what I'd like to do now, sir, is to put you a bit on the spot as we go back and tease out a little, at least, of these three themes that people can be on the lookout for in volume number one. So I happened to write them down from last time. Maybe you did too. But I have them right in front of me here. And the first one was power. Reflect for a few moments, please, on this first volume of the trilogy. And in terms of power, what do we see in terms of power?
When I was putting together thoughts on this, this conversation will probably be quite a bit longer because the next two simply build on these ideas.
Okay.
Once you get some of these locked in that first movie, the next two, you'll see all the pieces come together like cogs in a machine, how Tolkien brings us all together. Power in the first one. I was pondering this because right off the bat, you're going to hear somebody narrating a history of what leads up to the opening scene in Lord of the Rings. And that history is narrated by an elf named Galadriel. It's not in the book specifically as she narrates it, but it was given to us by Jackson and others to bring us up to speed, to put us in the picture of what we're going to do. You hear this lady narrating, and she talks about that there were rings given to the race of men, to the elves, and to the dwarves. And all told, there's a number of rings here that are given as gifts, and Sauron deceived them to the point where he made this one ring that would rule them all. And Galadriel talks about this, but they were all deceived. In the fires of Mount Mordor, there was another ring forged, and into it he poured his hatred and malice and desire to rule. This ring takes on a bit of a life of its own, the ring of power. And you know by the moment you get into the first scene of the movie that this ring is central to the whole thing, Lord of the Ring. Sauron is the lord of this ring of power. And this ring of power has twisted a hobbit-like creature named Smeagol, ends up with the name Gollum, but it's twisted him And you will see this through the whole movie, how this ring affects the different, I call them people, but it's different beings, elves,
right.
Mm-hmm. All sorts of things. So I'm going to say people most of the way through. Different people that it comes in contact with. This ring of power twists people. Tolkien does this wonderful thing, and this reflects what happens in the Gospels. In the Gospels, you have this idea where Jesus will often have a teaching where it's obvious, say, the Pharisees don't see the truth that he's teaching. Then he'll turn around and he'll open the eyes of the blind. And you get this physical picture that correlates to the spiritual condition of the Pharisees. They're blind. Amazing grace. I was blind, but now I see. Jesus regularly will do miracles that have a spiritual component, correlation to what he's been doing with folks spiritually. And you have this in Lord of the Rings. Smeagol, we find this out, starts out as a normal hobbit-looking being, nice-looking person. By the way, the actor that played that, kind of a no-name actor, but the richest actor out of all the Lord of the Rings actors.
And now doing a lot of other films as well.
Absolutely. He's worth like 2 point some billion. Anyway, that's an aside. By the time we meet him in Lord of the Rings, he is this twisted, somewhat balding, scrawny creature that grips onto this ring and has done so for hundreds of years. He loses the ring to Bilbo, the other hobbit we talked about, but it has twisted him, and he loves to hang on to this ring. He loses it. It becomes his lifelong quest to get that ring back, and that plays into the whole movie. But physically, we look at him and we think, this looks like some shriveled, raisin, evil-looking, bug-eyed creature that doesn't have much hair. I mean, that I can have some sympathy for, but what Tolkien's doing is showing the interior condition of what power does to people.
You know, something occurred to me. I want to stop you right there, because in comparing this concept with the ring with something that Hitchcock used to say in his movies, he would say that the core of his movies is a thing or an idea, but usually a thing that got lost and needed to be found, or was causing all kinds of chaos behind the scenes or making people miscommunicate or whatever. And he said, it doesn't matter what it is. And so he came up with the name MacGuffin. You probably know that. This was Hitchcock's MacGuffin. He said, it doesn't really matter what it is. It's a thing. It's a widget. It doesn't matter. The opposite in some ways is happening here, right? It does matter that it's a ring, and it does matter who made it. And as you said a few minutes ago, poured all of his rage and malice and evil into that ring. And the thing itself, far more than just a MacGuffin, the thing itself does in fact change characters. It has an effect upon the characters rather than the characters having an effect in some ways upon it. So it's an opposite to what Hitchcock would use as a device in his films.
There's one point in the movie where Boromir, he was one of the characters that goes along the Fellowship, holds the chain that holds the ring. Frodo has dropped it. And Boromir says something to the effect of, but it's such a wonder that we suffer so much fear and doubt for such a small thing. But you're right, it's not a small thing. And here is one of the things that Tolkien is doing. He is offering a massive commentary through this whole thing on the idea that power is not neutral.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said something to the effect of, if you really want to know the character of a man, give him power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you'll watch what he does with it. We have power used for good in the movie. There are times that there's lots of swashing and buckling and all sorts of fighting and use of swords, which for Tolkien was a last resort. He didn't like war, but there's lots of these things going on in the service of good, but it is always in service of the good, the right, and the true, and a quick means to the end.
I should say that one, I think, really good picture of what you've just said and having to do with power and the different kinds of it is when Gimli at the council says, well, I'll just break out my battle axe here and we'll destroy the thing and be done with it. And as you said earlier, that doesn't do it. And as a matter of fact, ironically, wonderfully, deliciously, the person there around the circle with the least amount of power is in fact tasked with taking up the principal role of being the carrier of this evil thing.
There's so much here, Pastor Chris, that I look forward to going into in depth when we meet in person. But what my encouragement to people is watch how each of the characters reacts to and interacts with power and what power looks like. I'll give you one quick example. One of the most powerful warriors in the saga, his name is Strider. We find out later his name is Aragorn. He becomes king of Gondor. He is 84 years old. He doesn't look it. I think the moisturizing lotion helped him, but he's 84 years old in the book. He's one of the Rangers of the North, a man of valor, all sorts of strength. He is the man. He's tempted to take the ring from Frodo, and I don't necessarily mean that he pursues it, but Frodo at one point opens his hand and says, "Would you take the ring?" And Aragorn kneels down and closes Frodo's hand over the ring and says, "I would have gone with you to the end." And then he turns to go and fight the people that are pursuing Frodo. And Frodo takes off on his own there at the end of the first movie. Here's one of the most physically powerful beings as far as fighters and an incredible warrior. His goal is to serve Frodo. But the goal of the ring is not to serve, but to be served. The goal of Sauron is not to serve, but to be served. So it's not that Tolkien is saying everybody should become sort of mealy-mouthed little worms crawling in the dust. We all have power, but it is not necessarily neutral. Power is always working out. The temptation in a broken world is always to lay hold of it in wrong ways, not to serve others, but to be served and to grab at it. And so, yeah, just keep that in mind, how each of the characters interacts with power. All right, onwards and upwards.
Got it. Steve Pearson, the next one is the idea of fellowship. And as a subheading, you said about how this group comes together and in some ways how they're bound to one another. Want to talk about fellowship a little bit? I mean, after all, it's in the title of the movie.
Being Catholic, Tolkien obviously has an incredibly high view of the church, and I'm going to have some fun here. Very much a strong ontology of the church and a participatory ontology. By that I mean, being Catholic, there is a deep spiritual requirement to participate in the Mass, a requirement to participate in the sacraments, to participate in confession, to be bound to others, not just because, hey, you know, I seem to do better in my Christian life when I hang out with Christians once a week, or as I will sometimes say, a holiness support group. Catholicism has an incredibly strong ontology of the body of Christ. That's why, who was it, Tertullian? I'm not going to get the Latin right, but there's no salvation outside the church.
Right.
The strong, strong understanding that you cannot live the Lone Ranger Christian life on your own. You cannot develop in moral fortitude alone. You can't do it. The church is not I've been burned by the church, so I'll stay away. That is simply not an option in true Catholicism. Now, apart from critiquing it or endorsing it, that's Tolkien's background. So what he's going to develop for us is this understanding that no one can do this on their own. The ring cannot be destroyed by someone on their own. This quest cannot be undertaken, and the quest is a development of each of the characters and the moral virtues in each one of them. And Tolkien doesn't pull any punches. They all have vices. But it's very clear in this fellowship that they develop them together, and they develop them in the context of fidelity and loyalty and love and commitment to each other to serve each other. Tolkien is serving the rest of Middle-earth by going to destroy the ring.
Right.
These warriors are serving him by physically defending him, by encouraging him. Sam serves him time without number throughout the book in so many ways. His gardener serves him. Hmm. So there's this idea of serving. Now contrast that with what we see with the orcs, which are the really mangled. Prepare yourself if you haven't seen the movies. The orcs are these nasty looking creatures that they, you know, two arms, two legs, faces, but twisted and evil. But they're constantly killing each other.
Right.
They get mad, kill each other, they get jealous, kill each other.
Feed upon each other, even.
They gossip and they kill each other. And that becomes a literal thing because they like to eat other living beings. You know, man flesh at one point is phrased.
Right.
They literally feed off each other in a destructive way. So here's where Tolkien's taking us. We have to be drawn together in fellowship and love for each other on this journey to develop moral virtue and strength of Christ-like character. Mm. And in a fellowship of mutual service and love.
There you go. Yeah.
And you see that demonstrated over and over, and we're drawn to beauty. I mean, as believers, I believe we have the most beautiful story there, but we're drawn to the beauty of these characters at different times saying to each other, we will go in service of this great quest to destroy the ring of evil, the ring of power. We will give our very lives to each other and for this cause. That's beautiful, as opposed to greedy beings that are killing each other.
Yeah.
This is what the church should be. We will give our lives for each other, in service to each other, if it will help you, my brother. So Tolkien just develops this beautiful picture of what I believe is the church is called to be.
Beautifully said. Yeah, they really will, and in some cases do, lay down their lives. Steve Pearson, we've talked about power, we've talked about fellowship. Now, number three, sovereignty and freedom. How would you look at this first movie through that particular lens?
I just finished a book last night by Fleming Rutledge, the Episcopal priest and eminent theologian. He's written some wonderful works. But she wrote a book called The Battle for Middle-earth, Tolkien's Divine Design in The Lord of the Rings, and it literally is a commentary, section by section, scene by scene, on the movie. I know that makes me a nerd, Pastor. I don't know what else to say. I have no life.
Well, but I'm with you. I'm right along there because I was thinking, ooh, that sounds really good.
It actually is one of the top books I would recommend, partly because she combines a depth of understanding of historical Christianity. She's rooted in classical Anglicanism, and she is conservative. So classical Anglicanism, so classical Christianity in some amazing ways. And she is a theologian par excellence, just amazing. I could go on and on because I've read some other stuff by her. But then when she enters into the Battle for Middle-earth, she's so well-read and versatile that she brings a lot of literary criticism to it as well. And she's a Tolkien fanatic, so it's not negative. A couple of times she says, yeah, it's a little bit weak here, but she really acknowledges his beauty. Now, the reason I say all this is the premise of her book, the main idea, she covers so much territory, but the main idea is Tolkien is basically expounding this idea that Augustine brought to us, that our freedom is found in lovingly serving Christ. Mm-hmm. That is where true freedom is found. And so this idea of providence and freedom are not really polar opposites. They actually end up being the same thing.
How so?
This is an amazing twist that she brings about, and I think Tolkien is exploring. So in this ring, we would say something, or in this saga, we would say something to the effect of, who's really free in this thing? That's the question, because as humans, we all serve some end. Okay, for example, if I get up from here and I say, hey, a bowl of ice cream sounds really good, I'm serving the end of my own appetite. If I say, I need to go out and paint my deck, which I do, I was working on that a little bit this afternoon, I'm serving the end of my own comfort and aesthetic pleasure as the summer goes on. I'm doing all of these things. I serve some end.
Right.
So the question then becomes, well, is the end destructive? Well, too much ice cream, yes, at the end of the day can be destructive. I could eat it morning, noon, and night, but I would be a well-rounded man at that point. But so I can serve that and become just a slave to my passions that way. Many people serve material possessions or prestige or sexuality or And all of these things are okay within certain bounds, within God-given designs. There are certain, very much certain things that are okay about a lot of this. But when I cease to make following Christ and his way of ordering things, when I cease to make that my goal, I will be a slave to something.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Now, God obviously designed us to be open and joyful in this world and to embrace it as he made it. So my freedom is found in answering his call on my life and my destiny to be his child and to live that out. That's where I'm perfectly free to be the person he called me to be.
Yeah, and the reason that I think, at least in part, serving Christ joyfully is actually where you find the most freedom is that truth that you said so beautifully, that we are made to and will serve something, and the enemy knows that. The enemy knows that. So there's a counterfeit service that is always offered, a counterfeit thing that looks like we're serving something that gives us freedom when in fact it does not.
Absolutely. And Tolkien shows this visually with things like Gollum getting all twisted, with Boromir, the end of the first movie, sort of losing his sanity for a bit in pursuit of the ring, and he becomes a twisted version of himself. Mm-hmm. It's so obvious we will serve something, even if it's our own security. I mean, had the disciples served their own security, the gospel would not have spread.
Indeed.
Now, the second thing that people will bring up in this is something to the effect of, well, let's talk about Calvinism. Let's talk about God's absolute sovereignty. You know, was it predestined Frodo do this? Therefore, Frodo had no choice. And that plays into it some, too. We'll just take it head on here. It's a little bit odd because in this movie you find, or in this saga, in this book you find Tolkien juxtaposing these two things side by side. For example, at the Great Council, you've made clear, more clear in the book, I'll put it that way, but you find Lord Elrond saying, you've all been summoned here to determine the fate, something to that effect, but you've been summoned here. In the book, it's clear that it's not Elrond that summoned them.
Oh.
That they have been summoned by, and Tolkien does not name it in the book, but by some external force.
Yes, right. Right.
Has summoned these people here to make this decision. You have Frodo standing up in the middle of this council going, I will take the ring, making the choice. However, in the movies, and I believe the conversation's put at a different place in the books, I don't remember exactly where, but in the movies, it happens in the Mines of Moria, you have Gandalf and Frodo, and Frodo says that incredible line, I wish none of this had happened to me. I wish the ring hadn't come to me. Gandalf responds, you know, so do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All they can do is decide what to do with the time that is given to them. There are the other forces at work in the world than evil, Frodo. Oh. And that means that Bilbo was meant to find the ring and you were meant to come into possession of it. And that is an encouraging thought. Within the same few minutes of the movie, you have this idea of there's this greater power at work, but also Frodo choosing. Dorothy Sayers was incredible. I believe in her work, The Mind of the Maker, talks a lot about this, how sovereignty and free will are more like an author and a story. And Tolkien reflects this too. He sometimes didn't know what was going to happen in his own story.
All right.
But there are other forces at work writing and playing out this story, but yet we are part of it, choosing that destiny laid out for us by the good. Can you choose against it? Absolutely. Boromir did. He chose against it. Sauron at one point way back in the history of Middle-earth did. Gollum did. Frodo makes the choice for the good. But throughout the movie, there's these hints all along the way that there are other forces at work, forces of good, that will bring things to rights in the end. Not a happily ever after. There's still pain and suffering and death along the way.
Yes.
And struggle in times where I don't know if we can go on. Frodo and Sam encounter this where it looks bleak for the good. But in the back of your mind you have, and there's these beautiful glimpses of that transcendent power of good. And we know this to be God working through the redemptive work of Christ, through the Holy Spirit, in all that is going on now. But but there's these little shots of transcendence in the book and then in the movie as well where, oh, good is working things out. But it's my call to answer in service to the good and to God.
The first of the trio of movies leaves us in a bit of a cliffhanger, and we are just certain things are not going to go well and or it's going to be really, really hard. However, you've given us lots to think about as we watch that first movie, and that little teaser at the in the end there that you gave that, yeah, good does prevail, but not without cost. Again, folks, we are talking with Steve Pearson about the first film in the series of three of The Lord of the Rings, this one called The Fellowship of the Ring. And we're putting it out here at the beginning of July in hopes that folks in our church, maybe you too, if you're just listening in, would like to listen to it and watch the first volume and then maybe come back and listen to it again to kind of get a second bite at it and see if you can trace out some of these themes. Steve, bless you and thank you. I'm grateful.
Well, I did have one final thought that might help folks as they watch the movies to get a grip on this idea of myth. Tolkien despised the use of his books and the story to support war. That was simply would have been antithetical to what he wanted. He did not like that sort of approach. He did not like his books being used to support more of a militant approach to, say, social issues in general. His thought more was that things are never that neat and clean. There's never the good guys and the bad guys, where it's us and them, and the West stands for all that's good and holy, and the East for the bad, or the Middle East for everything that's evil or whatnot. His idea was more that his story mapped on as well to the individual life, meaning within Steve, I find both Strider, Aragorn, the good guy, and Smeagol, the sneaker, the one that's grasping for power. I find that battle in me. I find Sauron raging in me at times on wanting to exert power in so many wrong, destructive, selfish ways. I find the nature, though, that is renewed by Jesus Christ, wanting to live in service of others, in service of the good. But Tolkien also wanted his myth to be mapped onto our lives and our own personal journey inside us. So rather than taking it and looking at it in good guy, bad guy terms, look in how this maps onto your own journey and how it maps onto the world around us in some ways as well.
I like that idea. So see, all this time, Steve, I just thought of you as a sweet little hobbit, but now I'm seeing you as a much more complicated creature. So folks, as you're watching this first in the series of three movies, Steve's just said, hey, rather than seeing big sweeping good versus evil, maybe think of it in terms of, hey, I see a little bit of Gandalf in me, or there I am being a little Saruman. Gosh, sometimes I wished I was Strider, or today I'm Boromir and I'm not thinking about letting this ring corrupt me or whatever. I love that idea. So we can kind of apply some of, well, several of the characters to us. Yeah.
That is the way I think Tolkien desired it to be read. In fact, in some of his letters, he does reflect quite a bit on the first move in war is dehumanizing the other and making them evil and us good. But his concern was far more, I think, on what's going on inside each human being and the battle for good and evil there. And that's why there is no specific Christ character. There's no specific, you know, mapping directly onto God or even Satan. And people will say, well, Sauron is Satan. Historically, though, he's actually one step down in Tolkien's history of Middle-earth from Satan. So you can't even quite make that comparison. So yeah, along the way, as you reflect on the movie, my suggestion is maybe take a walk after or later on a nice, beautiful afternoon or evening when it cools down and spend time in prayer. Say, God, what characters are striving together in me? In what ways am I Strider in a good sense? Mm-hmm. And living into what you've called me to be? And in what ways am I Gollum and power has maybe corrupted me some? In a personal relationship and my dealings with other people, whatnot, in what way have I grasped on to certain little bits of power just as hard as I can, and allow the Holy Spirit to work through your heart with those.
I love that idea. There you go again, being a wonderful pastor. Steve, bless you, and thank you. I'm grateful.
It's been a pleasure, Pastor Chris, and thank you so much for this opportunity and all of those things. And I so value your friendship and encouragement and all of those things wrapped into one. You are and have become the part of my fellowship on my journey.
Oh, bless you. Well, I'm just so glad we could do it together, as they say. And we'll be getting back together soon to talk about movie number 2. Folks, I want to thank you again for joining us in the Chapter House for this conversation. Steve, bless you. Thank you. And folks, until next time, the Lord be with you.
You've been listening to a podcast from Epiclesis, an Ancient Future faith community. If you would like to learn more about Ancient Future faith or worship at Epiclesis, visit us on the web at www.epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.